This is VOA News. I'm Victor Beatty. President Donald Trump Wednesday continued to speak out against Russian interference in the 2016 U.S. election. In an interview with Jeff Floor of CBS News, Mr. Trump was asked if he agrees with the assessment of the U.S. intelligence community Russia meddled in the election.
And I've said that before, Jeff. I have said that numerous times before. And I would say that that is true, yeah.
But you haven't condemned Putin specifically. Do you hold him personally responsible?
Well, I would, because he's in charge of the country, just like I consider myself to be responsible for things that happen in this country. So certainly, as the leader of a country, you would have to hold him responsible, yes.
In the interview, Mr. Trump said he accepted the view of his director of national intelligence. Moscow continues to be a threat. His White House spokesperson said much the same thing Wednesday.
We certainly believe that we are taking steps to make sure they can't do it again, unlike previous administrations. This president is actually taking bold action and reform to make sure it doesn't happen again. But he does believe that they would target, certainly, U.S. elections again.
Earlier, Mr. Trump defended his approach toward Russia.
We're doing very well, probably as well as anybody has ever done with Russia. And there's been no president ever as tough as I have been on Russia.
He said he told Mr. Putin Monday in Helsinki in a private talk that such interference will not be tolerated. The Russian leader said the Russian state was not involved in the U.S. election process. Ethiopia's main airline has resumed commercial flights to Eritrea, the latest sign of normalized ties between the former Horn of Africa enemies. Two Ethiopian Airlines aircraft landed in Asmara, one carrying dignitaries and business leaders, including former Prime Minister Haile Mariam Desalegn. This is VOA News. Even as Turkey prepares to end its state of emergency imposed after a failed 2016 coup, an American clergyman who has lived in Turkey for 20 years remains in prison, charged with terrorism and espionage linked to the attempted coup. Andrew Brunson insists he is innocent. No concrete evidence has been brought against him. He's been incarcerated for 2 years. He had a hearing on Wednesday. The American chargé d'affaires, Philip Cossett, was there. He's been watching the legal proceedings closely.
I have read the indictment. I have attended 3 hearings. I don't believe that there is any indication that Pastor Brunson is guilty of any sort of criminal or terrorist activity. My government remains deeply concerned about his status, as well as the status of other American citizens and Turkish local employees of the U.S. diplomatic mission who have been detained under state of emergency rules.
Additional anonymous witnesses have been produced, forcing a delay in his legal difficulties. His next hearing scheduled October 12. In southwest Syria, rebels in the bombarded city of Nawa surrendered to pro-government forces. It was the last major urban area in Daraa province still under opposition control amid a Russian-backed offensive that began in June. At the same time, an evacuation of pro-regime fighters and their families in 2 Shia villages in northwest Idlib province is underway. British Prime Minister Theresa May Wednesday said her government has begun negotiations with the European Union on her divorce plan called Brexit, which provides a closer relationship with Brussels than many of her conservative supporters want.
The Chequers Agreement, the White Paper are the basis for our negotiation with the European Union, and we've already started those negotiations.
Earlier in the day, Boris Johnson, her former foreign secretary who resigned his post over the so-called Chequers plan, told Parliament the government must rethink its strategy.
It is not too late to save Brexit. We have time in these negotiations. We have changed tack once, and we can change again.
Ms. May this week won narrow victories on a customs and trade bill, but was defeated on another amendment, underscoring her fragile coalition ahead of the momentous break from Brussels scheduled next March. European antitrust regulators Wednesday fined Google $5 billion, ordering it to stop using its popular Android mobile operating system to block rivals. Google's Android system runs on about 80% of the world's smartphones. It has 90 days to halt what the EU sees as its anti-competitive practices or seek a delay as it appeals. On Wall Street, another big day with solid earnings reports. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News. We'll be right back.
Morning, Africa, and welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington, and today is Thursday, July the 19th, and here are some of the stories we are covering for you this morning. The South Sudanese warring parties meeting in Khartoum failed to agree on a power-sharing deal. The Sudan government agreed to create 5 vice president posts, including a first vice president, but opposition members rejected that proposal. And 2 Ethiopian airline planes landed in the Eritrean capital Asmara on Wednesday as Ethiopia's main airline resumed commercial flights to neighboring Eritrea. This is one of the latest signs of normalized ties between the longtime enemies.
The second one was just carrying ordinary people, just guests. And these guests include not only Ethiopians, but also Eritreans who were separated from their families.
Tewolde Wolde Gabriel is a reporter for VOA's Horn of Africa service. In July 18th is International Mandela Day. The day is marked around the world, especially in South Africa, where South Africans pull out the stops to do good deeds in memory of the late Nelson Mandela.
We celebrate him because he gave us an opportunity to democracy. Today, it was a great day for us.
Jegofatso Seripe is a chef in Johannesburg, South Africa, among a group of chefs who gathered to cook 100 meals for the public in honor of Mandela's 100th birthday. And President Mnangagwa assured journalists that they are free to be critical of him and his government. But the organization that represents journalists in the country says that even though such overtures are good signs of progress, it is not time to celebrate yet. We'll bring you those stories and more coming up right here on Daybreak Africa. We'll start in Asmara, where 2 Ethiopian airline planes landed in the Eritrean capital as Ethiopia's main airline resumed commercial flights to neighboring Eritrea. This is one of the latest signs of normalized ties between the longtime foes. Passengers included former Ethiopian Prime Minister Hailemariam Mariam Desalegn, who upon landing led the travelers off the plane and onto a red carpet at the airport.
The mood was very exciting. Early on in the morning, residents of the capital, Asmara, showed up at the airport, decorated with traditional dresses, holding banners, flags of Ethiopia and Eritrea, singing the traditional song. Then just before noon, the first plane just arrived. The former Prime Minister of Ethiopia, Hailemariam Desalegn, embarked along with the CEO of Ethiopian Airlines. And this group was welcomed by Eritrean Foreign Minister Osman Saleh and Eritrean Airlines officials.
That's Tewolde Wolde Gabriel, a reporter for VOA's Horn of Africa service. He was at the airport in Asmara. In the Sudan capital Khartoum, South Sudanese warring parties meeting to work out a peace deal to end the 5-year war in the country failed to agree on a power-sharing agreement. South Sudan Information Minister Michael Makuei said that the government agreed to create 5 vice president positions, including a first vice president, but opposition members rejected the proposal. Observers say that the impasse jeopardizes recent positive steps that had brought President Salva Kiir into a meeting with his rival, Dr. Riek Machar. So what happens next is an open question, and to help us get an understanding of what is happening between the warring parties, I spoke to John Tanza Mabusu, the managing editor of South Sudan in Focus, here at the Voice of America.
The government of South Sudan and an umbrella of different opposition groups were supposed to sign an agreement on power sharing during a transitional period. That is, if they agree on everything, there will be a transitional period in South Sudan for 120 days, and there will be some arrangements on who is to do what and when and where. And so this proposal was given to the parties 1 week ago to look at. And They were supposed to get a final document on Monday and then sign it. But the alliance of the South Sudan opposition groups, that's an umbrella of armed and unarmed opposition groups, rejected the proposal.
So why are these opposition groups refusing the power-sharing deal?
Yeah, the power-sharing deal has its own problems. One of it is that it is recommending that South Sudan should have five vice presidents. You have a first vice president that will be given to the rebels of the SPLM-IO, headed by Dr. Riek Machar, and then you will have Kiir having two vice presidents, the current one, Jimmy Swaniga, and then Taban Dengai, who was appointed in July 2016, right after conflict flared up in Juba. And then the opposition will be given an opportunity to nominate two other candidates for the position of vice president. One of these candidates must be a woman. So the opposition groups are saying, this is just to accommodate them, and they're not willing to get into such deal. So it talks about reducing the number of ministries in South Sudan. We have 45 ministries. They are talking about 35, and then also reducing the number of lawmakers in the country.
Okay, those are members of parliament. Now, in terms of the vice presidents, are they going to have equal power, or there's going to be a vice presidential figure, say, Dr. Riek Machar, would be more powerful than the others, than, say, Taban Dengai?
Well, in that proposal, it appears like there is no hierarchy in terms of who is going to supervise who among these five vice presidents. It just says, for the purpose of protocol, you will have the president, the first vice president, and then you have other four vice presidents.
Is this hierarchy issue also a sticking point? Is this one of the reasons why they are not able to agree to the deal?
But the opposition did not express that. But talking to some opposition figures, off the record, they're saying like to have like five vice presidents. Who answers to who?
So what happens next between the government and the warring parties? What's the next move? What should we expect?
I would start with the latest. South Sudan government just wrote a note to Dr. Dediri Muhammad Ahmed, who is the Sudanese Minister of Foreign Affairs, who has been like, if you like, mediator in Khartoum during these talks, and they expressed two issues that the government is also now refusing to sign a document that was their blueprint. Because this power-sharing proposal was a blueprint of the government, snipped into the presidents of Uganda and Sudan, so that they can present it to the warring parties. But now the government has turned around to say, no, we don't want to be part of that. Even reasons that, one, there is linguistic errors in parts of the document. They are also saying that there is a lack of logical sequence, inconsistency, lack of clarity, and inappropriate drafting of the documents. They are also saying that it fails to justify and reconcile the Entebbe agreement. So they are just giving a menu of their reservations.
John Tanza Mabusu is the managing editor of South Sudan in Focus here at the Voice of America. And yesterday, July 18th, was International Mandela Day. And this year marks 100 years since the birth of Nelson Mandela. The UN says that the centenary is an occasion to reflect Mandela's life and legacy, and to follow his call to make the world a better place. In South Africa, the Nelson Mandela Foundation is dedicating this year's Mandela Day to action against poverty, honoring Nelson Mandela's leadership and devotion to fighting poverty and promoting social justice. From Johannesburg, South Africa, Nadia Sami reports on some of the activities that took place around the country to commemorate the anti-apartheid icon's birthday.
The buzz around Mandela Day is amplified this year as the much-loved anti-apartheid activist would have turned 100 years old. Nelson Mandela is being immortalized in acts of kindness being carried out around South Africa. Most of the projects last for 67 minutes in honor of the 67 years Mandela spent in public service. In Johannesburg, a group of chefs gathered to cook 100 meals, and on the menu was Mandela's favorite dish. The process was overseen by Mandela's former cook. This chef, Tsekofatso Seripe, says the day was a delicious success.
we celebrating him because he gave us an opportunity to democracy. Today it was a great day for us because we were dishing up his signature dish, and the turnout was well, because and we had entertainment from the Cuban choir. Madiba's favorite dish was semp, which in Xhosa they call umushu, and mogodu, which is tripe, ox tripe. So as we were discussing what to do today, one of my colleagues, he came out with the idea of making a mogodu pie, which is mogodu means tripe. So the inspiration behind mogodu pie was the cottage pie. So we used tripe instead of the mince and semp instead of the mashed potato.
Volunteers at One Small Act of Kindness are also rolling up their sleeves. They're making sandwiches and distributing them to schools and informal housing settlements. They're also hauling out their paintbrushes to touch up schools that can't afford to do building maintenance.
We put our pleas on our Facebook page, and one of the pleas was looking for paints and rollers, art supplies for the children and stationery. And the response is always overwhelming. We will be painting the grade R class as well as the outside jungle gym and the exterior walls to just brighten up their school.
These are just some of the service initiatives being carried out in the name of the man who devoted his life to the service of others. For VOA Africa, I'm Nadia Sami in Johannesburg.
And we stay in Southern Africa, in Zimbabwe. The Union of Journalists is warning its members against the thinking that the environment is now conducive for free media as the country prepares for the July 30th elections with no major incidences. For more on this, Sebastian Mofu reports from Harare.
On Wednesday, President Emmerson Mnangagwa released a video on Twitter saying Zimbabweans were free to criticize him. That is a sharp contrast to what his predecessor Robert Mugabe did during his nearly four-decade rule, which ended last November. But Foster Dongozi, the Secretary General of Zimbabwe Union of Journalists, say it is early days to pop the champagne.
Then I warn strongly against rewarding a government or an establishment for being good or appearing to be kind. As the media, we should always have a healthy sense of skepticism around politicians. Coming from a Robert Mugabe era, it is quite easy to start celebrating these small victories. We continue to record cases of violence against journalists by all sides of the political divide, from the MDC alliance, from ZANU-PF. So yes, it's not full-scale violence against journalists as during the time of Robert Mugabe. But again, we may need to question who were Mugabe's enforcers, who were implementing these draconian laws under Robert Mugabe. Is it the same people who were there during the time of Robert Mugabe? Is it the same people who are there now? So hence the need to be cautious around celebrating these not-so-significant developments.
Western governments and human rights groups used to accuse Mugabe's regime of enacting tough media laws, which resulted in some media outlets being closed and some journalists being arrested or deported. Since the coming in of President Emmerson Mnangagwa, those incidences haven't happened, but the laws Mugabe used against the media remain in place. Hence the call by the Zimbabwe Union of Journalists for its members to be cautious, especially as the country prepares for the July 30th elections, in which Mnangagwa faces challenge of Nelson Chamisa of the Movement for Democratic Change Alliance, among other 22 candidates vying for Zimbabwe's number one job. Despite promising a credible election, the opposition says Mnangagwa's ruling ZANU-PF party and state security forces continue to manipulate the Zimbabwe Electoral Commission as what used to happen during Mugabe's 30-year rule, which ended in November when the military briefly took over. The opposition earlier this week said it had already written to the leaders of Southern Africa to mediate or Zimbabwe have a sham election. The opposition says it has not been given the voters' role to be used during the election, which it says it wants to check for ghost voters. Sebastian Mofu for VOA's Daybreak Africa, Harare.
Access to reliable and efficient ferry services has been Gambia's problem for a long time. There is only one new ferry in Banjul, the capital city, to transport the increasing demand of commuters and goods from Banjul to Bara in the northern bank region of the Gambia. The Banjul to Bara ferry services is one of Banjul's most important economic lifelines. Gambians who use this route say that there are few ferries on this route, and many of them are old and decrepit, with users often complaining that they are overcrowded and often break down mid-crossing. Now, Gambia's president, Adama Barrow, says he has a solution for this problem. He plans to build over the Banjul Barra crossing. And reporter Pan Derimbai has more on this ambitious plan.
The actual cost for the proposed Banjul Barra ferry crossing bridge has not been disclosed by the president. But administration sources said the bridge is going to cost government $1.5 billion. And it is going to be a Chinese government-funded project. President Adama Barrow broke the news during the Meet the Farmers tour.
Why son plan bi moy dañu def bridge digante Banjul ak Bara. Te amna compin bu ñoo waxtanal sun waxtan sori na ci te amna yaakar.
He says there are plans to construct a bridge between Banjul and the Bara ferry crossing. He also said talks are underway to finalize the bridge contract. He says come 2019, the foundation stone for the bridge would commence. Building such a high magnitude bridge in a poor country like the Gambia is not a developmental priority, according to Ousmane Diatta, the deputy party leader of the APRC.
For bridging Banjul and Bara, why can't we try to buy the farmers enough and so on that are in the circles? And also, before we try to bridge Banjul and Bara, why can't we try to stabilize our electricity system? Let him not embark on a promise that he can never keep. Because I believe somebody said it's going to cost us about $2 billion. $1 billion is no small money. How are we going to fund it? Where is the fund going to come from? What are the strings attached to said fund, if at all it is available?
Jata is not alone in calling for government restraint in spending. The International Monetary Fund, IMF, in a recent statement, also said the Gambia's debt stock has risen to about 130% of the country's gross domestic product, GDP, at the end of 2017. IMF says the greater chunk of the debt is owed to external creditors. It also notes that to maintain debt sustainability, it will require the Bara government to refrain from contracting new debts. Omar Ba is the executive director of the Rhode Island-based Refugee Dream Center.
The Gambia does not have the funds to build this, and if they have to do it, must be by loans, which will further put stresses on our economy. And also, it is not the priority of the Gambia. We have ferries that are not functioning. They cannot even maintain those ferries. There is long lines for people to cross that river. So if they cannot maintain, which actually needs less money, how can they build $1 billion worth of bridge?
Analysts warn that there are tough conditions associated with Chinese loans. For example, they said countries risk losing their sovereignty in the event they defaulted in paying such loans. Sri Lanka is a case in point, where the government owed over $8 billion to a state-controlled Chinese firm. The country had to hand over its ports to the Chinese company.
A good example of failure and disaster of Chinese-funded project is Zimbabwe as an example. Zimbabwe took so many loans and then it created so much stress on their economy and local currency to the extent that they had to abandon their currency.
Bas says the Gambia has other pressing economic priorities to take care of than resorting to misplaced priority projects. He says Gambian hospitals are poorly equipped, resulting to many patients dying, while the educational sector is in shambles.
Gambia's priority is the healthcare, basic needs in healthcare, basic food, just the basic needs for a human being to live, not building mega projects that are not necessary or that are not actually feasible both economically and politically at the moment.
Gambian political analyst and writer Alhaji Yoro Jallo, in an op-ed, notes that the proposed bridge would cost more than a third of Gambia's tax revenue. He also says it would cost half of the country's annual export earnings, including interest rates. For VOA Daybreak Africa, this is Pan Derimbai reporting.
A new report from the World Resources Institute estimates that more than 50% of the world's land is held in a collective manner. This land is often held by indigenous communities under tenure arrangements that are not formalized. In effect, this leaves them open to insecurity as more and more companies mine for natural resources in rural areas. Peter Viet is the director of Land and Resource Rights Initiative at the World Resource Institute. He talks to reporter Ricky Shryock about Tanzania's unique process that gives indigenous communities collective land legal titles, a process that could be used as a model for other countries.
What's unique about Tanzania is that many of the communities there, maybe 70% of the land, 65% of the land, is recognized as village land. And most of that land, estimates are somewhere between 85 and maybe upwards of the villages actually have certificates of village land. So they do have title. And in many ways, the procedure by which communities acquire documentation, procedure that's outlined in Tanzania is actually possibly a model even for other countries. So there are some best practices coming out of Tanzania. That doesn't necessarily mean, of course, that the land is always secure. And we do have quite a bit of land that's being, in Tanzania, quite a bit of village land that is being transferred to so-called general land, which is government-managed land, and then reallocated by governments to companies for investment purposes. So the challenge in Tanzania is really the conversion process.
What kind of hurdles exist when we talk about this idea of land ownership, just in general? Many communities all over the world, people don't technically own the land. And I think maybe when mining companies or these multinational companies come into play with this very specific idea of land being something that one can own, it maybe does it clash or create difficulties preserving land?
Yeah, I mean, in Tanzania specifically, the land law, the village land law, which regulates the community land, it's actually quite strong. Although, as you may know, there is a process underway right now where the government is developing a new national land policy, which will likely result in new national land laws. But the village land law is quite strong the way it is currently. It actually does not require a formalization for recognition of those community rights.
What are you guys looking for in terms of concrete steps that can be taken to preserve these land rights for indigenous people and communities?
So overall, Tanzania, as I mentioned, was a little bit of an exception in that they have a fairly streamlined process. Most countries around the world do not have a streamlined, fair, accessible process to formalize for indigenous people or communities to formalize their land rights. They have to. They're complicated procedures. They are costly procedures, both in terms of time and in money. And it often requires technical skills that the community doesn't have. In Peru, for example, communities are required to develop a soil map as part of the process of getting a title. So one of the recommendations is obviously to streamline and make the process more accessible.
That was Peter Viet, director of the Land and Resources Rights Initiative at the World Resource Institute. He was speaking to reporter Ricky Shryock from the Rhode Island in the United States. And that's it for this Thursday, July 19th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this morning with us. Join us again tomorrow for more African news and features right here on the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Rika Shryock, I'm Jackson Mvunganyi in Washington, wishing you a very good morning, Africa.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, host Shaka Sali broadcasts live from Harare, Zimbabwe, as voters prepare for the presidential election on July 30th. The Voice of America and the Zim Papers television network team up to present a presidential debate.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.